Everybody's got a history, so I thought I would start this with giving you a little bit of an introduction to how I got into the secret doctrine, how I became interested in it, and where I'm sort of coming from in everything I'm going to say tonight. When I was in high school, my aunt was the head librarian up at the University of Texas in Austin, and you may or may not know it. For many years, all that library was housed in this big tower building. And one of the privileges of having an aunt who was in that position is that she could get you into places in the library where just everybody couldn't go. And you could ride on the funny little elevators that went up and down in that tower, and you could prowl around and look in the stacks at all of the various books that they had there. And so when I was prowling around in those stacks and looking around at the various books about the peculiar subjects that I was interested in, as a kind of an unusual high school students. One of my teachers one time said, "Why don't you play baseball like other boys?" But at any rate, I was going up and down looking in there, and I found this big fat book, The Secret Doctrine, The Synthesis of Religion, Science, and Philosophy. And I got my aunt to, you know, check it out for me, and I took that thing and stared at it and looked at it and thumbed through the pages. And for some reason, there was just an incredible resonance with me of the phrases in that book. You had strange statements like the spark hangs from the flame by the finest thread of Fohat. And I thought, well, that's just the neatest thing. I don't have the slightest idea what that means. But doesn't that sound neat? You know, the last vibration of the seventh eternity thrilled through infinitude. Well, what a great statement, even though I didn't really know what it meant. But it was an incentive to study more, and so as soon as I could, I ordered a copy of that book, and I began on my own to try to read it and try to study, and there was a group of active theosophists in San Antonio, so I would go and ask them what it meant, and I got many helpful hints and many not so helpful suggestions, and at any rate, it just began what's become a study lasting literally decades. And I guess at this point, I certainly wouldn't claim to be any kind of an expert at all on this subject. I still scratch my head a lot in trying to read this book, but I found it a very fruitful source of ideas for meditation and inspiration. And what I thought I would do tonight is basically just to share with you some ideas and some approaches which have meant something to me over the years in getting into the secret doctrine and in trying to wrestle with that book and wrestle with those ideas that are contained in that book. These things that I'm going to share with you, I think, will help you whatever level you might be, or at least give you some ideas that have been helpful to me. And so I just listed these things as just little sort of pointers, and I just want to go through these and give you some examples of what I'm saying and how you can apply these things. The first thing I wrote down is that the would-be student of the secret doctrine needs to build up a general background of knowledge. And I mean in all areas. And I don't mean as a scholar, but just as an inquiring, curious person who wants to learn a little bit about all of the subjects of religion, science, and philosophy, which is supposed to be represented in this book. Now, that's, if you think about, I mean, what a nervy title for something, you know, the synthesis of religion, science, and philosophy. I mean, you know, that's going out on a limb just to say that that's what you've done in this book. But certainly that implies that you must have some kind of an understanding of religion, science, and philosophy. And how many of us can really claim to have a real good acquaintance with these subjects? But the interesting thing is that today we've got more of an opportunity to build up this general background of knowledge than probably people have had in any other time. There is just so much in print. With the internet, we have access to so much information that we didn't have earlier. If you're curious about, if HPB mentioned Shankaracharya, you type that name in and you'll get a zillion different internet sites where you can go and look for further information. So there's really no excuse for staying uninformed with all the plenitude of stuff that's out there. We complain a lot about these big bookstore chains, but they're absolutely marvelous in that you can walk in there, go to the philosophy section, and find just innumerable surveys of basic philosophical ideas and systems that you can read. You can walk into the religion department of that bookstore and find huge numbers of books on all of the various religions and books on comparative religion in a way that, it's at your fingertips if you just, for the trouble of just walking in there. Same way with science, book after book after book. It's very popular these days for people to write all these kind of books about science, and you have people, of course, this at all different levels, but even the greatest researchers out there have felt impelled to put down their observations and ideas and to write these books. So all of this information is available, and I'm suggesting that the questions that were being asked, the basis questions for the inquiry that was going on in the days of the early Theosophical Society, these are the same questions that people are still asking now. And I don't care whether we're talking about religion, where we have, again, a world in which we've got very, very fundamentalist approaches advocated by many people on all sides. We've got a tendency to back up all of a series of beliefs with quotes from the Bible or the Quran or some other text. All these things were going on back then or at that time, and so you find all of the quotations from these sources that HPB does to show a familiarity with those different religions. In science, you've got the same questions. What is space? What is time? What is matter? All of these questions that they asked then, they continue to ask now. In philosophy, people continue to ask the same questions because basically we're the same human beings that we were a century ago or indeed a million years ago. And so all of these topics that are dealt with in the Secret Doctrine are very contemporary topics. But at this time, we have access to more information, certainly than they did 100 years ago, the average person. And we have the ability to go and to acquire this background of general knowledge that we need to deal with the Secret Doctrine. Okay, having said that, we need, and the second thing I wrote down is to get a general map of the territory. And what I mean by that is that we get some kind of an idea of how the Secret Doctrine is laid out so that we won't be just lost in the details, because we can get into the words, into the details, into the allusions to all kinds of authorities of that time and get absolutely completely lost in there without having a general overview. So if we look at the Secret Doctrine, and those of you who have, this will be just review for those of you who have looked at it some, but basically it's laid out in two or possibly three parts depending upon the editions that you get. And understanding a little bit about the history maybe will help us to see how this came about. But as the book was published in 1888, it essentially at that time had two volumes. Okay, volume 1 dealing with cosmogenesis, and volume 2 dealing with anthropogenesis. Genesis is the origin of things, so this is the origin of the universe. And anthropos is man in Greek, so this is the origin of the human race. So we're dealing with the creation of the universe and the creation of humanity within that universe. Now within both of those volumes, we have three sections that follow from one to the other. First, we have a section based on stanzas from an obscure Eastern text referred to as the Book of Zion, D-Z-Y-A-N, which no scholars have been able to actually find or locate. There's people who spend their whole lives looking for the Book of Zion. Nobody's found it. HPB said that this was in the possession of her teachers in Tibet, and that the stanzas that she quoted in the Secret Doctrine, or that in fact became sort of a skeleton on which the Secret Doctrine was based, was a traditional text in the hands of students in the East. So we have stanzas from this book of Zion, and we have commentaries on those stanzas. And the same way in the Anthropogenesis volume, we've also got stanzas and commentaries here. Now, these stanzas are in no sense complete. HPB said that she took the relevant, applicable stanzas that give sort of a creation myth or a creation story and left the hard ones out. So we can probably be thankful that we just got the easy ones left here in the Secret Doctrine to deal with. At any rate, stanzas and commentaries, and then a section after all of this commentarial material on symbolism as it appears in the world religions, and this is also reflected down here in the second volume. And in fact, this is just a continuous list and continues and spills over from the first into the second volume. And here we have all kind of subjects, the symbolism of fire, the symbolism of the lotus, the symbolism of heaven, the symbolism of the zodiac, the symbolism of all of these things as they relate to the story of creation that's being told in the Secret Doctrine. And then finally, the third part in each of these parts is a portion on science as it relates to the Secret Doctrine. Okay, so this is the Secret Doctrine as it appeared in 1888. Now, it's interesting to notice that this is among the latest material that HPB wrote for the Secret Doctrine. When she began to write the Secret Doctrine, it was intended originally as a rewrite of Isis Unveiled, which was her earlier textbook. And so the Secret Doctrine was intended to be a rewrite of Isis with additional commentaries and information. But in fact, most of that material ended up in HPB's drawer. As she began to work with this original plan of rewriting Isis, she was given more and more and more information on various subjects, and that came to make up this Volume 1 and Volume 2 that was published. The original, very earliest stuff that she wrote ended up, as I said, as material which really didn't fit anywhere in the published document and, in fact, had not been published when she died. A few years after her death, it was published as a third volume of the Secret Doctrine. And this was published as a volume that is generally just titled Occultism. And literally is this hodgepodge of material that was left over and didn't really fit anywhere else. To this was added some material that HPB had prepared for her students in her esoteric school. And this material was given out under pledge of secrecy during her lifetime, but with the idea that after her death, it would probably be published in some form. So these papers that were circulated as sort of, you might say, her secret teachings were published as a portion of this third volume. But again, this is posthumous, and she probably would have made a lot of changes in this material before it ever got out. Now, HPB tended to use a little bit of what's called hyperbole. So in her writings and in the first couple of volumes, you can find a number of places where she spoke as if this third volume was already complete, a done deal, and even she even speaks of a fourth volume. Well, I think serious people have looked into that and decided that the evidence really supports that this was in hyperbole, and that actually she was referring to this pile of stuff in her drawer, which in her mind was just about ready, but in reality still required a lot of work to do in order to put it out. Now, some people would disagree with me. They would say that she actually had a completely finished third and fourth volume, and that somehow this was spirited away by the masters or hidden by somebody who didn't want it to see the light of day. And as much as I would like to believe that, I think that a serious study of what she said would be in the third volume and what actually is in what we've got suggests that this is exactly what it is. At any rate, this is an overview of the territory, and basically what we're going to be talking about is the first two volumes, this 1888 work that she put out. It's now available from a number of different sources. You can get it in one big, huge volume, which was the one that I found when I was in high school. And you could carry, the nice thing about that, you could just carry it around. And this is put out by the Theosophy Company from Los Angeles. The Theosophical University Press also publishes an original, and in the claim of this big one is that it's a photographic reproduction of the original 1888. So it's there, warts and all. So other people through the years have been felt obliged to come and clean up her grammar and make corrections, but none of that has been done in that big book, and also with the one published by the Theosophical University Press, which exists in two volumes. But again, we're dealing there with the original text and the original pagination. Our society publishes a edition by Boris Dzerkhov of this material, but he has used his liberty as a scholar to clean up some of these things, and so it's although a very excellent version, I think, it still has the imprint of his editorial hand on it and can't be said to be the original words exactly of HPB. And when somebody does that, many times you're doing the author a favor by trying to clean up some of their mistakes. Somehow you can also get into trouble, and in several places I think Boris Dzerkhov has done that. He's got into a little bit of trouble by correcting mistakes which weren't mistakes, or correcting things in ways which have later shown not to be right either. One thing I would say tonight, if you don't take anything else home from this, it's don't be scared of the secret doctrine, and don't worry about which edition you're going to read. Just jump in and read it and try to get something out of it. And so don't be afraid of the abridgments. There are abridgments around. And for the people that, you know, don't want to, I mean, I think it's nice if you can read the original text, but there's nothing wrong with the Cliff Notes, you know, to get started. So this is the Cliff Notes version, and, if you know, that's more than a lot of people have read or will ever read, and so if you can tackle that, that's worthwhile too. So get a general map of the territory so you know where you're going in there. Spend a lot of time flipping through the different pages and just reading the different titles of the different pages, because this is the way that you'll make an acquaintance with what's there. There's no substitute for just personal, hands-on experience of thumbing through and, you know, just open it up any place and start reading. This is one approach. In fact, it's been said with some of HPB's writing, especially Isis Unveiled, that you can almost interchange any paragraph with any other one and have an unchanged edition. That's a slight exaggeration, but there's some truth in it, that a lot of this material is almost like a hologram, in that it's all spread out throughout the whole book and not located in any one place or the other. And the same way with the secret doctrine. You may be right on one page and think you're going to get to something which, in fact, shows up much later. And part of the reason it's like that is, as I said originally, the way the secret doctrine was written, the order that it was put together, was not at all the way that it finally ended up. When HPB had just moved from Belgium to England, some young, scholarly, helpful people came around her and wanted to help. She says, well, you know, what I've got to do right now is get this book out, and I've been writing this thing for years, and we've just got to get it out. And so would you have a look at it? And so she handed them a big pile of manuscript that had been accumulating for quite a period of time. And it was a man and his nephew, who were both about the same age, who got this job. And they've written some very interesting stories about this. They got to looking at it, and they realized, they just shook their heads, and they said, this is like Isis Unveiled, except much, much worse. You know, if there's ever going to be any hope of sorting this out, it's going to have to be in a completely different order from the way that it's all piled up and thrown at us. So what they did is to literally type all, they didn't want to go chopping up her original thing, so they typed it all out by, you know, just laborious typing, and then proceeded to sort it out and came up with this scheme, which she said was okay. And once she had bought into that, then it became just a matter of slicing the whole thing up and putting it in this order. But the order as we've got it is nothing at all like what it was originally. It would be interesting to know, you know, the secret diary went through at least three different phases. The first is when it was just going to be a sort of a rewrite of Isis. Second, it was going to be in four big volumes that were called the Archaic Period, the Ancient Period, the Medieval Period, and the Modern Period, and each one of those was going to have 12 parts. Well, we just have no idea what on earth it would have ended up like if it had stayed in that same order. But at any rate, then that was all sliced up and diced and changed around, and this is what we ended up with. At any rate, this is why an idea that you find there in some part of the commentary on the stanzas in Volume 1, maybe that thread takes up somewhere down in the symbolism part of the second volume. Well, simply because, you know, just like these continents apparently were once together and spread out, some of this material was once together and now is in different places in that book. So this is part of what's going on. Okay, the third suggestion is to follow HPB's hints on how to study the secret doctrine, and especially to focus on what I like to call her laundry lists. HPB was great at making laundry lists, and in this she followed sort of a general tradition in the East, you know, where they're always listing the, you know, the five elements and the seven ways to bliss and the 12 causes and, you know, all these kind of lists. And so HPB was very much in that tradition. But she said that if you're going to try to make sense out of the secret doctrine, begin by focusing on those laundry lists and looking at them and getting the big picture of the ideas that are contained there. So the first place she said to look was in the early portion of the volume number one. There's a whole section in there called the proem. Unfortunately, a lot of people never make it past the proem, but at least I guess it's a start. But within that section, there are what have been called the three fundamental propositions of the secret doctrine. And she says, even if it takes you months or years, try to get a handle on what is being given out there as these three fundamental propositions. And just in a nutshell, what those are is first the idea of unity. Everything is one thing. This is not a pluriverse, this is a universe. Everything is one. Okay, the second is the concept of cyclicity or periodicity. Things go in cycles. And whether we're talking about the daily cycle of just waking and sleeping, or we're talking about the yearly cycle with the seasons, or whether we're talking about the cycles of reincarnation, whether we're talking about the cycles of a race or of a planet or of a solar system, we're dealing here with just different expressions or manifestations of one underlying law, periodicity, cyclicity. We breathe in and we breathe out. We wake up, we go to sleep. And these things alternate. It's the sine wave, the sinusoid. We find that all through nature. And then the third fundamental proposition that's mentioned there is the idea of evolution or unfolding. Within these cycles, there is a progression. And this progression over millions of years is a sort of a parallel evolution of the form that we know and study in science, and the consciousness or life that some way or another animates that form and becomes conscious through that form. So this great evolutionary effort spanning literally millions of years works its way from a formless gas cloud nebula to a planet, to the mineral kingdom, plant kingdom, animal kingdom, human kingdom, and beyond the human kingdom to other forms of life that we can't even imagine. And this progression, this unfolding, is this third concept of the that's given in the proem. Now, one thing that a lot of people don't focus on too much, because these are, after all, pretty easy ideas to relate to, but to this, HPB adds in the original introductory portion of the Anthropogenesis chapter some rather strange ideas. And it'll take me just a second to try to find this. But I want to read those to you too, because these fundamental propositions are not nearly as obvious. but they're thought-provoking. She says here, as regards the evolution of mankind, the secret doctrine postulates three new propositions which stand in direct antagonism to modern science as well as to current religious dogmas. It teaches, A, the simultaneous evolution of seven human groups on seven different portions of our globe. B, the birth of the astral before the physical body, the former being the model for the latter. And C, that man in this round preceded every mammalian, the anthropoids included, in the animal kingdom. And now maybe you see why we don't talk about these too much. Okay? These are pretty far out even today, because they clearly proclaim that man or humanity is fundamentally a spiritual being which by a process of evolution became encapsulated, enclosed, encased within a physical form. And that this, almost like in Star Trek or something, where when they beam up from somewhere, it's like you have this invisible form which grows and gathers the atoms and molecules of the physical world around it. In this way, somehow humanity is said to have formed. The birth of the astral humanity before the physical humanity. Humanity began as a spiritual being and literally fell into matter. We have the old legend in the Bible about the coats of skin that were supposedly given to the early human race. And this, HPB is not talking allegorically or symbolically here. And the fact that she's quoting science and she's quoting geology, and in her worldview, this is really the way that the human race came into existence. From these ethereal prototypes, from a spiritual humanity that preceded the physical humanity that we know today. And part of this was also this third thing, that man in this particular cycle preceded every mammalian. In other words, if we look in our science books, we see the nice pictures of the, little tree shrew that grows into the monkey-like creature who grows into man, and, you see him gradually standing up. Well, according to HPB and the way that this worldview that she was giving out, that's not at all the way that it happened. She'd perfectly well agree with the observation of science today that like 99% of the DNA was the same in humanity as in the monkeys, but she utterly reverses the order so that all of the mammalian life, including the monkeys, were actually offshoots of this early human form, which is held out as sort of the prototype of all life. And again, this sounds very weird and bizarre, but I would be less than honest if I didn't say that this is what was being presented here, not something that jives perfectly with our modern evolutionary ideas. And again, HPB certainly talked about evolution, but she did not talk about evolution or did not understand it in the way that our modern scientists understand it today. Okay, some more laundry lists. She has several, and here she's got another group that appear right at the end. The proem is at the beginning of this part, right at the end of these stanzas and commentary. She's got six numbered items she says also you should focus on. Briefly, what are these? First, the fact that the secret doctrine is the accumulated wisdom of the ages, and its cosmogony alone is the most stupendous and elaborate of all systems. She says that this accumulated wisdom was passed down from one generation of learned human beings to the next until finally we have it in the form that she embodied it in her writings. The masters or wise men of the East that she studied with were the successors of these earlier generations of wise men who promoted this teaching. Secondly, the fundamental law in that system, the central point from which all emerges and around which and toward all gravitates, and upon which is hung all its philosophy, is the one homogeneous divine substance principle, the one radical cause. This is in a way a restatement of that first fundamental proposition, the idea that everything is rooted in what she calls the divine substance principle. Now, this is what in ordinary talk we'd say God, okay? But the idea here is that this is a divine principle that is, you know, dwarfed or limited by calling it God or Allah or by any name like this. But the idea is that behind all of the forms and names in the different religions, there's simply the idea that there is a unity behind all existence. And that's what we're talking about here. Third, the universe is the periodical manifestation of this absolute essence. So this one thing becomes differentiated and becomes itself the entire universe. It doesn't make the universe out of some extraneous material. It itself, in its substance aspect, becomes the universe. Fourth, the universe with everything in it is called Maya, the Sanskrit word meaning illusion, because all is temporary therein, from the ephemeral life of the firefly to that of the sun. So everything is Maya or illusion. An oversimplification, perhaps, of the Eastern idea in which Maya was regarded as sort of the power of the deity to display different parts of itself or in a playful way to become and manifest itself as the whole universe. So the universe is all Maya because it's the illusions cast forth from this one substance principle. Fifth, everything in the universe through all its kingdoms is conscious. That is to say, endowed with a consciousness of its own kind and on its own plane of manifestation. So everything is alive and everything is conscious. There's no such thing as dead matter anywhere in the universe. Sixth, the universe is worked and guided from within outwards. Now, we all know that on our own private individual level, the fact that we do anything or bring anything about comes about from an idea that starts out in our minds and works itself into a physical expression. This is commonplace. But she's extending this to the universe as a whole. The idea here is that the universe, in some sense, is a mental creation. The universe is somehow the embodiment or the expression of some divine thought. And in her thinking here and in the thinking of her masters, this is very close to the ideas of Plato and the other old philosophers who said that this external world that we see around with our senses is the reflection of an ideal world somehow existing in the divine mind. And again, she states this as a fundamental principle. Okay, that is those six statements, and we have what she calls five proven facts. And I'm not going to go into all of these. I think what I want to give you the idea of is that you will find in there these laundry lists. And that if you will take those laundry lists and meditate on each idea in there, you'll find keys that open up a whole world of philosophical thought. There were, in addition to all of those things, four basic ideas, another laundry list that she gave privately to these people who were trying to study the secret doctrine. And she says, try as you're reading this to relate it all back to these things. And very briefly, these are A, the fundamental unity of all existence, which we've mentioned before. Second, this idea that there is no dead matter. We also mentioned that a while ago. Third, the basic idea that man is the microcosm, in other words, the small universe. And fourth, the basic idea is the great hermetic axiom summarized as above, so below. So these, again, are four guiding principles that we should hang on to. They used to say like grim death as we deal with the secret doctrine. This was also mentioned by G.R.S. Meade, who was HPB's secretary for a while and worked in putting together this third volume on occultism, when he reviewed all of HPB's literary work. And his comments on looking back at the whole thing, he said where HPB was at her very best is when she was simply speaking as a teacher of occultism and giving her own ideas. Where she's at her very worst is when she's quoting other authorities in order to try to prove what she was saying was true. And you find that HPB, unlike a lot of people who are, you know, most writers are not at all embarrassed to give out their own ideas and say, oh, I made this up, I'm a brilliant person. Sheba, on the other hand, was always trying to show that, no, I didn't make any of this up, I'm just getting this from other sources. And so she had a tendency to quote people who nowadays we don't regard as authorities at all, in some kind of an effort to support and substantiate and relate what she was saying to the ideas of that time. So we want to focus on HPB's statements. And so this is my next little hint here is look for statements beginning like the esoteric philosophy teaches. The occult doctrine states. There's lots and lots of these examples, but that's where she's at her very best. Okay, and to just give you a few examples, I went through and just listed some of these things where you can just get an idea of some of these kinds of statements. And these are, you know, very dogmatic statements. I mean, the bang, there it is. But they're nice, and if you want to get the essence of HPB's philosophy, this is what you should focus on. For example, here, the secret doctrine teaches the progressive development of everything, worlds as well as atoms. And this stupendous development has neither conceivable beginning nor imaginable end. Our universe is only one of an infinite number of universes, all of them sons of necessity, because links in the great cosmic chain of universes, each one standing in the relation of an effect as regards its predecessor and being a cause as regards its successor. Here's another example. The doctrine teaches that in order to become a divine, fully conscious God, I, even the highest, the spiritual primeval intelligences must pass through the human stage. And when we say human, this does not apply merely to our terrestrial humanity, but to the mortals that inhabit any world. In other words, to those intelligences that have reached the appropriate equilibrium between matter and spirit as we now have. Here's an example where she contrasts science with the ideas of occultism. She says, science teaches that the living as well as the dead organism of both man and animal are swarming with bacteria of 100 various kinds. But science never yet went so far as to assert with the occult doctrine that our bodies, as well as those of animals, plants, and stones, are themselves altogether built up of such beings, which, except larger species, no microscope can detect. Now, I hope you get an idea of what I'm trying to say, that these are the little pearls or gems that you find in the secret doctrine, not the reference material to older philosophies or to contemporary authorities. Okay, another thing that I've listed here is to meditate on the headings at the tops of the pages. And those of you who have read The Secret Doctrine, I don't know if you noticed, but at the top of every single page, there's a little phrase that more or less summarizes some big idea contained on that page. And those little loaded phrases in themselves are enough to provide plenty of food for thought. I wrote down just a few of these just to give you an example. At the top of one of the pages it says, the absolute knows itself not. Top of another page it says, primeval radiations from the unity. Top of another page it says, conscious electricity. What does that mean? Top of another page it says, the four dimensions of space. Top of another page it says, metaphysical chemistry. Okay, if you didn't have anything else but just those little phrases at the top of those pages, those are enough to unlock incredible avenues of thought and exploration. But every one of those can be referenced then and explored in the light of what's given on that page. So meditate at the headings at the top of those pages. The seventh little hint that I wrote down here is ask yourself, how does this relate to me? Okay, it's very easy to get wrapped up in this as some sort of a philosophical, metaphysical discussion of things out there. You know, how did the universe come about? what is the nature of atomic matter, what is the soul, what is the spirit, what are the stages that humanity has gone through. But what we need to always be doing is thinking back, how does this relate to us? In other words, when HPB talks about the elements in the universe, she spends a lot of time talking about the traditional earth, water, air, and fire. And yet every one of those elements that are in some sense out there are also represented within our bodies. We've got the earth elements that we get with our food. We've got the water element of our blood and those various, the lymph and the urine and all of the fluid parts of our nature. We've got the air that we breathe and that animates this physical body. And then we've got the spark of whatever goes on in metabolism that's literally like burning all that food, a metabolic fire-like process that goes on. And we've got the space that contains all of this and permeates all of the atoms. So we have the five elements within ourselves. And part of the whole exploration of the secret doctrine is to relate those things to ourselves. When she tells us about these ancient races, when she tells us about the Atlanteans and the Lemurians and all of these old races that were supposed to exist, this is not about other folks. This, if we believe or buy into the story in the Secret Doctrine Cosmology, this is the history of ourselves. It was us who were the Atlanteans and the Lemurians and who lived on the moon chain before the earth chain. So this goes along with the teaching, and we have to try to relate to that. If we're learning about how the different parts of man come together, or the human being come together, and if we learn that there's a part that has some way evolved up from the lower forms of life, and that this is somehow met by a part that is sort of involving from a higher state of life, and that this comes together to give life and mind and consciousness to the being that we call humanity, this is, again, the history of ourselves. When we're studying about these different parts of the human being that come from these very different origins and which are all together in this one being, this is nobody else. This is no abstract thing in a book or in a painting. This is us. This is our consciousness. This is our heredity and our origin. And that's what we need to keep in mind. Okay, the next little hint is look for the hard parts. Okay? It's our natural human inclination to seek the easy parts that we can really get our hands on and be happy with that. But the secret doctrine contains lots of really puzzling parts where you read it and you just say, huh? What is that? Those are the parts where it's trying to crack through to a higher level of understanding. And so precisely those difficult parts are the ones that we should focus in on, not the easy parts. So look for the hard parts, intentionally look for the hard parts, embrace the hard parts, and try to figure out what's going on. Another suggestion, and I guess I should have said this a little bit earlier, but it doesn't really make so much difference, the order, is put yourself in the position of a student in HPB's time. What I mean by that is to realize that this book, this document, was written in a particular time speaking to certain people. Yes, the message is in a sense perennial and speaks to us today. That's true. But the background of knowledge of those students who were reading that is essential. It's essential that we understand what their background was in order to understand why she was speaking as she was speaking. And with all of the enormous number of theosophical books and with New Age books and with material that we're bombarded with and that we have on all sides, it's easy to forget that at that particular time, as far as explicit theosophical doctrines, all that people had was Isis Unveiled, Mr. Sennett's Occult World and Esoteric Buddhism, the articles that had come out in the Theosophist, a couple of books by Dr. Hartman. And this was essentially the theosophical literature at that time. So she addresses ideas from that material, and that's where she's coming from in many ways. So one has to go back and look at that original source material. Read Isis, read esoteric Buddhism, read Dr. Hartman's books in order to get an idea of where she was coming from. Now, I know that we're surrounded with later generations of theosophical books. We have the works of C.W. Leadbeater and Annie Besant. We've got books that people like Alice Bailey and Rudolf Steiner have written. And many people just swear by this and this kind of material and have apparently got a lot out of it. And that's just great, and I'm not knocking that at all. But I'm saying for the purposes of studying the secret doctrine, for the time being, if you've studied a lot of those other second and third generation theosophical things, at least sort of set them up on a shelf and realize that that particular material and approach was not there at that time. So take a diet for a little bit from Alice Bailey or Rudolf Steiner in order to see what she's saying. And then later, having understood and having got an idea of what's there, then it's perfectly great to bring those other people in and see what kind of insights they may give you to add to your insight and to give you other ideas. But don't try to read the earlier book in the light of the later material of these different authors, or I think in that way lies a lot of confusion. Finally, and I'm going to wrap this up, is to see all of this in a fresh way with the eyes of a child. And again, I refer you back to my experiences as a high school student thumbing through the secret doctrine. And when I get bogged down in all of it, I try to get back to that childlike kind of state of mind where I first discovered these ideas and where I first began to feel some kind of resonance in myself. And I suggest that to everybody as you read it, to read it in a kind of a naive way. It's okay later on to go in with your skeptical scholarly deal, but take a little time to be kind of naive and childlike and read this almost like you were going to a Star Wars movie or something and really get into to what she's saying. And then you can analyze it at a later time. But keep your eyes open and look for secrets beyond what is spelled out in the text. I think this kind of writing speaks in a way that is uniquely speaking to our inner selves from a plane beyond the rational, intellectual, slice and dice mentality. And I think this is what HPB is trying to do largely, is to press us up against these big fundamental ideas, to confuse us enough to put us beyond our ordinary way of thinking so that we can come up with some insights from a higher level. Okay, I'll quit there, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to...
Yes, sir. Do you actually know who wrote those running heads in the secret
doctrine? I don't. A lot of this material, it's interesting if you really look into how it came about. They say when she first wrote the secret doctrine, the commentaries were not nearly as elaborate as they are now. And people complained and said, well, you know, why haven't you given us more commentary? She says, well, it's as plain as the nose on your face. And they said, well, we still need more. She says, okay, well, you could write some more. If you think of, here's a piece of paper, and if you've got some additional stuff, put it down there. And so she gathered up this stuff literally from other people, edited it, and beefed up the commentaries to where they are as it now. So it's not at all unlikely that later people in putting this together wrote those headings, and, you know, we don't know. At least I don't know who actually did it.
Has this had a big influence on you and doing your job?
It's just, yeah, it's somehow sort of the background of everything I do and think, I guess. You know, it's just always there. And I'm in science, you know, and we do things that, you know, continually make you ask big kind of questions, you know. And I find this extremely helpful, and I think that HPB was, you know, whoever wrote that was way ahead of their time, in my humble opinion. Uh-huh.
Can you say a little bit about what it is that's in this material that mm-hmm. brings you to live in a, you know, so that...
Yeah. I think I understand what you mean, and one thing, it's really, I've looked through the secret doctrine, you know, to see what's actually said in there about a concept which appears in a later book that HPB wrote. She says it comes essentially from the same source. This is the Voice of a Silence. But in the Voice of a Silence, there's a passage there where she's talking about this absolute principle, you know, that we've dealt with in the Secret Doctrine. And she says that this principle is compassion itself, is love itself. And you get this more in that, in the Voice of a Silence, than you do in the Sacred Doctrine. But what I mean by is when we talk about this one abstract substance principle, it sounds like we're talking about an impersonal, unknown thing. And yet, the philosophy underlying all of this is that that one principle is essentially goodness, is essentially harmony, is essentially compassion, that it's actually a spirit which animates everything. And so when you really get into it, you realize that this oneness of everything is not just something that you mentally talk about in trying to dissect the world, but that if you reach down into the depths of yourself, and that's what we're getting at here. We're looking into the depths of ourselves as the microcosm within this bigger universe, and we find that in those depths is a level that is all compassion, that is all love, that is all harmony. And we're, you know, once you've got the idea that the universe is grounded in this compassion and harmony, then I think that's going to rub off on your life, and it's going to make your life different from the way it would be if you just thought this was just a blank nothing back there. Because it's not just a blank nothing. She refers to it as the heart of being, the heart of all nature. So, and then in the Voice of a Silence, and really, the Voice of a Silence, since she says it comes from these same stanzas, should be thought of as sort of a continuation of the Secret Doctrine. So in the Secret Doctrine... Well, you can do whatever. Yeah, why not?
You can recommend it,
well, not necessarily, but certainly in parallel, but to give you the idea of where all of this is going. Because truly, in the Secret Doctrine, these thoughts are not carried out in the ethical depth that they are in the Voice of a Silence. But as I say, it's a continuation of the same stanzas. And so once we move from this material, which is dealing really with the origin of the universe, the origin of nature, then we move very naturally to what's in the Voice of a Silence, which is experiencing that nature within, which she says is absolute harmony and is absolute love and is absolute compassion, and then working that out within our own lives. So this is part of what I mean when I say we ask, what does this really mean to me?
Could you elaborate on the seven human groups?
Oh, the seven human groups. Basically, if we go back to the origin of humanity in this cycle, she speaks of, it's almost like seven families of spiritual humanity waiting to start up mankind in this cycle. And literally, as it's like seven families which then multiplied and became all of the different races. So that's about the best I can do. It's, if you want to think of it as, there's a series of sevens that runs all through the Secret Doctrine. This is just one of the sevens on a very local level. And you know, like in the Bible, when it talks about the Elohim, it's translated, let us make man in our own image. But if you really get into it, the Hebrew word there is Elohim, which is a plural word. And it's, in according to HPB, it's talking about these early families or progenitors of the human race. And so let us make man in our own image means that these primordial, original, human, astral families reproduced themselves and gave rise to our humanity.
Is what's written in the book particularly consistent or inconsistent with the major religious works?
Her big object was to show that it was. And I think you can make an awfully good case that if you look in the esoteric or the inner teaching of virtually every religion, you find these big ideas there. And her analysis of what was being said in Genesis, I think, makes a great deal of good sense. And then people have now, with the availability of lots of Eastern literature that wasn't available earlier, they've looked into the Tibetan creation story, the origin of the human race and everything, and find you know, very good similarities to what she was writing in here, where, again, they talk about an early race of human beings that they said had bodies of light and lived on, you know, they didn't eat or whatever, and they gradually materialized and the sexes divided and they began to eat. It's exactly the same story. So I think she's certainly, you can certainly make a case that what she's given us here is just what she said it was. And it is, in fact, kind of a synthesis of all of these traditions. American Indian tradition has some other traditions that are very, very similar to what's in this book. Okay? But if I've done nothing else, I just want to give you the incentive to investigate and to inquire and to have a look at this book if you haven't looked at it before.